Hello, America and the world. This is Radio Free Market, and I am your guest host, Luke McGrath, sitting in for Radio Free Market founder, Michael McKay. We are behind the lines of socialism, my friends, and Radio Free Market is the voice of free people and free markets. Our topic today is, who cares about lower prices? Answer, consumers. And our guest is Dr. Paul Prentice. Welcome, Paul.
Yes, thank you.
Now, let me tell you just a little bit about Dr. Prentice. He is a founding faculty and professor of economics at Yorktown University. He's an adjunct fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute and the founder and president of the Pikes Peak Economic Club in Colorado. Every one of us is intimately familiar with prices because buying and selling is so much an everyday part of our lives. How do prices in markets come about?
Well, prices are determined by a very elegant, complex, and unplanned process of consumers on the one hand pursuing their willingness to buy something based on their individual values, and their individual values are very time and state and place specific, so they change over time, but it's really your willingness to pay as a consumer to go out and purchase something and how much you're willing to pay for it, and that is then brought into an agreement with a producer who's willing to sell. So you have somebody who's willing to sell, somebody who's willing to buy, and they agree on a price. In modern economies, you don't see that so much at work because prices are just sort of set in the broader marketplace, and then you have prices there. But you see it at bazaars or in more developing economies. You see people always bargaining over price until they reach a price that makes sense to the consumer that at the same time makes sense to the producer. And to make sense to the producer, that price has to outbid their opportunity cost. It's got to at least pay them to do what they're doing. Otherwise, they wouldn't be providing that good or service. So prices, just they're a fabulous market signal.
And that's also, prices are like signals, aren't they? They convey information to people.
Absolutely, very much so. The price it's what I would call an information-rich variable. It is full of so much information. If you think and you go to the grocery store, for example, and you just see a gallon of milk there and it's $2.75, well, these days $3 perhaps, or $3.25, whatever that price is, well, you just don't think that much about it other than you think, are you willing to pay that price? And if so, how much would you like to buy at that price? But captured within that price are all of the values and all of the willingness to pay of all the various consumers involved in that market, and there might be millions of them. And if it's a global product, billions of them. And captured in that price is simultaneously the producer's opportunity cost, their willingness to produce and sell something, captured in that market price as well. So everything from the value of the alternative use of the resources involved in producing the milk to the value to the consumer from purchasing and consuming the milk. That all of there isn't something you just say $2.99 at the grocery store, you don't even think about it. It's almost mystical in its majesty.
Do you think it's fair to compare the marketplace sort of like as a voting system, like when we go out, we cast a vote with our dollars?
From the consumer's perspective, absolutely. And presumably you're going to find some producers that will willing to supply you at that price, and if not, then the price will change.
Would you be able to expand a little bit on the role of profits then? What function do they serve?
Profits are really, if you will, a difference between two prices. It's the difference between the price you as a consumer would be willing to pay and the price at which it outbids the opportunity cost of the producer. So it's really the spread between the revenue that somebody would get and the cost it would cost them to produce something. So the role of profits is very important. It's two prices in that profit, the profit spread per unit, if you will, and that's a market signal. And if that spread is large enough, it will induce people to have more resources involved in that market and produce more. And if the profit spread is not enough or if it's negative, it tells resources to go elsewhere, to do something else.
Great. Well, that brings us right up to our first break. So we will be right back in a minute. This is Luke McGrath on Radio Free Market. Okay, and we're back. with Dr. Paul Prentice, and we're discussing prices and the pricing mechanism. Now, before we went to the break, we were talking about profits and the role that they serve in an economy. But what about then losses? What purpose do they have?
Well, just as positive profits induce more resources into that activity, it's a positive signal. Negative profits, losses, are a signal to get out for those resources to go and do something else. So both profit and losses are involved in what we as economists would call optimally allocating resources. In other words, having resources go to their best use. And the best use is certainly not one where they'd be losing money. So losses are very much a part of a capitalist market system, as are positive profits.
There's no, what would you say to someone who talks about like a fair price? They'll say they don't mind someone selling it, you know, at a certain thing, but the price for something, it should be fair, it should be a just price.
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting question, Luke. The idea of a just price or a fair price really goes back into history, the Spanish scholastics and a lot of early philosophers, including Aristotle, were wondering what was behind a price, what did a price mean, and what would you call a fair price? Well, with an understanding of Austrian economics, you'd have to say a fair price is the price. In other words, there's no way to make a value judgment to say as to what a fair price is, and if you would even allow the value judgment to be made, you must ask yourself, who is to make that judgment? A fair price to me as a consumer, that's one I'm willing to pay. A fair price to me as a producer, and I am both a producer and a consumer, as a producer, a fair price to me is a price that induces me to supply something. So fair, it simply has no meaning in any kind of real economic sense.
And then it also used to be believed that prices of things were determined by their costs of production, but this isn't true though, is it?
Well, over long periods of time, the market forces of supply and demand would drive prices towards the cost of production. It doesn't mean at any one snapshot point in time price equals cost of production. And in fact, at any one point in time, in order for an activity to occur, that price has to at least outbid the cost.
Yeah, because I guess, but there's a difference though, isn't there, between when a price over time tends towards its cost of production. And I guess the people who still believe in the labor theory of value. Would you have to explain to us what the labor theory of value is and how that differs to the subjective theory of value?
Sure, that's a much more complicated question. But the idea was originally proposed, and really it comes out of a little bit out of Adam Smith, but then taken more by David Ricardo. The idea that embodied in a product, let's say an automobile, embodied in the price of that automobile is the value of the labor that went into it. Okay, but we know there's also other things that went into it, but at least it's the value of the labor that went into it. And a lot of economists in the early days focused on the idea that, well, a fair price would then be the value of that labor that went into it. But they ignore other costs such as capital and land and other things.
But then that was overturned. It was shown that that wasn't the case.
Yeah, it was overturned primarily by what eventually became the early founders of the Austrian School of Economics, in particular Menger, spoke of the subjective theory of value. Well, that's just as true at the final product stage as it is at the demand, the drive demand, if you will, for the inputs into that product. It's very much subjective. Depends on how much you're willing to pay for milk. Well, that's the same thing if you're a producer of milk, how much are you willing to pay for tiresome labor to help you produce your milk? It's very much subjective. Depends on your particular values, your particular opportunity costs, your time and place. And that's why you can't really say what's a fair price or a fair wage.
I think that can sort of partly be explained by the diamond water paradox. Would you be able to tell listeners what that is?
Well, sure. It's, what is more valuable to life, diamonds or water? Obviously, water, you couldn't live without it. You could live forever without a diamond. You don't need a diamond. But water, you need a certain minimum amount every day just to survive. You couldn't live for 3 days without some water. So
but
you
then
would think it was just based on the value of the water in that sense, the price of the water would be higher. But that's not what determines its price.
Yeah, that's right. So then why, people would say then, why is it that if water is so important for life, you know, it's essential, why is it then that diamonds cost so much money?
Well, yeah, let's just take a look at water. Water is very abundant. The H2O molecule exists all over the earth in many different forms, and it's fairly easy to get at it. So regardless of how valuable it is to people, the fact is there's close to an infinite supply. It's a very large supply of the water, so it doesn't take much cost to produce the water. You have to have supply and demand determining that price. And on the other hand, with diamonds, they really aren't necessary at all. But yet, people that are wealthy enough will be willing to pay a very high price, but there aren't that many people, compared to the world's population, willing to pay that high price. But think about how few diamonds there actually are compared to the amount of water. So it's not just whether something is a necessity or how much of it there is relative to what people are willing to pay. And the fact is, diamonds are priced higher because they're scarcer.
Yeah, I guess one way to think about it is if you were to ask someone who is in, let's say, stuck in a desert, and if they had a diamond on them, would you prefer to have water or a diamond? Well, in that situation, of course, they'd prefer to have the water. But when you're living here in a city in society, when we have, as you're saying, abundant amounts of water, well, then you would choose to have the diamond. So I guess it depends whereabouts you're actually located in your situation at the time and so on.
Yeah, that's right. Look, we speak of the price in some sense reflecting the relative scarcity of that product.
Yeah.
And so, you know, your idea of somebody in a desert, well, that's really scarce and you really need it. You'd pay everything you owned, wouldn't you, to have that extra cup of water? Under that circumstance, you would, but that's not the circumstance of most people. For most people, their circumstances, water is abundant, it's everywhere, it doesn't cost much to provide it, and therefore, no matter how much it's valuable to them, they don't have to pay very much for it.
What's to stop a business person from raising the price of their goods to an astronomical level that some people fear is that we need to have the government ensure that, you know, yes, you might be able to make a certain amount of profit, but you can't charge a really, really high price. What stops people from?
Well, what stops people from charging whatever they want are consumers, isn't it? You know, if you, whatever you have, and even if it's a pure monopoly that you have, that you're the only person in the world providing this product, you can only raise the price to the point of people's willingness to pay. You raise the price beyond that, you're not going to sell any of it. So the market has limits there, and the more competition there is in the market, the more that limits your upward potential to raise a price. And in fact, if you want to really make a large amount of money, you're better off producing something at a low price and selling a large quantity of it. That's how Rockefeller got rich. That's how Steve Jobs got rich. That's how Bill Gates got rich. They developed amazing things that people really wanted, and they sold millions of them. They didn't sell just a few computers.
So in a market economy, then, it's us, the consumers, who are in charge.
Yeah, yeah. The producers, what can they do? They can offer things to us, and then we have the choice. They don't stick a gun to our head the way the government does. Okay? We don't have to purchase or consume their product or service. So we have the choice as to whether we wish to buy that or not. So consumers are the ultimate control in a market-based economy. And it doesn't have to be what economists call pure competition. It just has to be something reasonable where people have choice.
Maybe just touch on that just a little bit, the difference between what some economists, what they call pure competition, and then the more Austrian version. What are the differences between those two?
Well, this takes a bit of an econ geek to follow through, I'm afraid. But the idea is, for the more of a traditional, if you will, or classical or neoclassical economist, the idea that pure competition meets certain abstract conditions, such as there's so many buyers and sellers that no one of them can influence the price, and they're selling relatively homogeneous, similar or close to similar substitutable products. And under those conditions, they derive a theoretical equilibrium at which you have a certain quantity supplied and demanded at a certain price, and the market clears. But an Austrian economist is not really interested in that snapshot in time at which we have a price and quantity on an axis. An Austrian economist is interested in what do people do? What's the human action? What are the forces at work driving an economy? So you don't even have to have competition or perfect competition. All you have to have is people have choice as producers, other people have choice as consumers in various things, and the forces drive towards that abstract competitive equilibrium. They never actually get there. And I'm always amused by my fellow economists who claim that, well, here's the market and a snapshot in time, and there was excess profit being made, and therefore it wasn't really competitive. And they're not seeing that they're taking one frame out of a moving picture. They're not seeing the moving picture, that the forces are constantly pushing of consumer demand and producer cost. They're constantly pushing towards a competitive equilibrium. They'll never reach it, and they don't have to reach it. All they have to do is move towards it.
So I guess they're looking at the economy as something which is static as opposed to seeing it as a dynamic system.
Yeah, and it's even more than that, Luke. It's not just a matter of being static or dynamic. It's a matter of even those that look at it dynamically, they look at it mathematically dynamically. You know, it's a derivative of something over time or something like that. But we look at it in terms of how do people behave? How do people act? You know, when Mises wrote his brilliant book, Human Action, it really gets into psychology and human behavior. What is it about us that as consumers seeks a lower price, but as producers seek a higher price? Then how does this all go about happening to create an economy, a market-based economy? And that's really the elegance of the Austrian school. It's just so much richer. It's involved in philosophy and history and economics in a traditional sense, but it's so much more than the sort of classical ideas.
All right, great. Well, that brings us up to the end of our second segment. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. This is Luke McGrath on Radio Free Market. Okay, and we are back with Dr. Paul Prentice. And the next question that I have to ask is, when a natural disaster strikes, it's not uncommon that the prices of essentials such as food and water and batteries and things like that they skyrocket. And the people who are charging those much higher prices are usually vilified, and they're accused of profiteering, and they're called price gougers. But are they really doing a bad thing, though? Because higher prices in an emergency can serve a number of essential functions, don't they?
Well, yeah. Then they're not only not doing a bad thing; they're doing a good thing. If you think about it, when people are demanding, say after natural disaster, and they're desperate for water, they're willing to pay more for the water. But yet there's less water available because the natural disaster has disrupted the supply, it's natural for that price to want to rise. And what sellers do will then follow that natural force and charge the higher price, so the market will clear. If they didn't do that, there would be more people wanting to buy the water than there were people willing to supply the water. You'd have shortage, you have lines, you'd have tremendous problem with allocating that scarce resource. And furthermore, that high price, although it might not create profit in that local area because cost of providing it's very high, there's a signal outside that area for someone else to get a truck, fill it up with bottled water, and drive it down to, New Orleans or someplace, and start selling it. And as more and more supply comes in from outside based on that high price signal, that force drives the price back down again. But without that initial high price, you'd be stuck in a continuous shortage. There would be people probably dying of thirst, waiting in line for their water.
Talking about prices as signals, that's one of the troubles is, I guess, the government intervenes in the market in so many different ways, and they distort all of these signals. And that then affects incentives, and people change their behavior and so on. There's a good anecdote, actually, from Australia, where I was born. The government was concerned about low birth rates, and so in May 2004, they announced that they would issue what they called a baby bonus of $3,000 to children born after July 1st of that year. So you can probably guess what happened. Expectant mothers near their due dates delayed plans for cesarean sections, and they did just about anything they could to hold off giving birth. And the number of births in June actually declined, and then on July 1st, Australia experienced more births than on any single date in the previous three decades.
But I'm shocked people actually breed for money, huh?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, it's the same experiment we ran here in America and most of the Western world, where for decades we paid people to have babies out of wedlock, and the next thing you knew, we increased the supply of babies out of wedlock. And then we had welfare reform. We reduced or cut those payments or eliminated many of them, and what do you know? There was fewer babies born out of wedlock. People went to work. People follow incentives, and that's what Mises is talking about. Human action is just natural for people to do that. And when the government has no idea what they're doing, when they interfere with this natural price process of price discovery of people's values and people's costs, they have no idea of the secondary and tertiary consequences of what they have done. It's impossible for them to see things through to the second and third level of incentives that they've created for a system. They distort it so badly. We don't even know. We sit here in America, and the market is so much distorted in almost everything. You don't really know what an actual price would be absent government interference. You don't know if the milk would be $5 a gallon or $1 a gallon. You don't know if the gasoline would be $10 a gallon or $2 a gallon. You don't know absent government interference. There's so much interference in these markets. We really don't know what the natural price or the supply and demand equilibrium price would be.
We're coming up to break in a couple of minutes, but this is a good area to discuss is some of all the different ways that governments distort prices and then what are the effects of them doing that. So a price ceiling, for example, would you try to explain to our listeners what a price ceiling is and then what the effects of introducing it are?
Sure. A price ceiling is a price which by law, by force of government, it cannot go above that price. It acts like a ceiling on your house. You know, you can't go above that. If you tried to jump, you'd hit the ceiling. So the price is held below where it would like to go by government control. And think about it. When that happens, that means the price is lower than the market would want it to be. Well, at that lower price, there's more people want to buy it, but fewer people want to produce and sell it. So the price ceiling would create a permanent shortage type of situation. There would be more demand than there is supply. And that's one example of the way the government interferes in markets.
Rent control, that's an example of having a price ceiling. What happened when they introduced rent control?
Well, yeah, when they introduced rent control, next thing you know, there was a shortage of available rental units. And what happened, those people that had rental units, if you had a long-term lease on it, all of the value of that got capitalized into your lease. So people are buying and selling leases on the black market, renting out to neighbors and friends. It's just amazing, the distortions and the secondary effects. And then the tertiary effects of that are with the price ceilings on rent, with rent control, you as a producer, you have little incentive to produce new housing, and you have very little incentive to keep up the housing that you have. So you tend to get deterioration, you get low quality and low quantity when you have a price ceiling.
I think I've seen a presentation before by Walter Block, who's been on the show a number of times, and he had put an image up of two contrasting images. One, I think it was of bombed out cities during World War II, and then the other one was some cities that had introduced rent control, and it's actually, the game is to try and spot which is the one that was bombed and which is the one with rent control. It's actually quite difficult. But that actually brings us right up to a break. So we will be back. I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Prentice on Radio Free Market. All right, and we are back. This is Luke McGraw, and I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Prentice. Before the break, we're talking about some of the ways that the government distorts markets by intervening in the price mechanism. What about a price floor? What is a price floor, and then what are the consequences of introducing one of those?
Sure. A price floor is the opposite of a price ceiling. That's where the government would, by law, not allow a price to fall below a certain level, which implies that the market price, left to itself, wants to be lower than the government decides it should be. So they impose what's called a binding price floor, and they bring out the guns of government to enforce that, and they say the price cannot go below this amount. And if you think about it, what that means is that the price is higher than the market would want it to be, So at the higher price, there's fewer people wanting to buy it, but more people wanting to produce it. So it creates the opposite of the shortage. It creates a surplus, a permanent surplus. When you say a permanent surplus of anything anywhere in the world, you can bet there's a government price floor involved in that. And a classic example in America are the price floors or the subsidies to agriculture, where we have chronic surpluses in America, the overproduction, that would just not occur in a free market.
So what happens then when they introduce that? There'll be much more produce created, more produced than there should be. What does the government usually do to try and address that?
Well, then it faces its secondary problem now that it's messed with the market. What does it do with the surpluses? Well, typically what it will do is it will buy them off the market from the producers, from the farmers, because private people aren't willing to pay that price. So they buy it off, and then they ship it around the world. They dump it on the world market. Now think about what that does as a tertiary effect. You're growing corn maybe in some country in Africa, and the next thing you know, the U.S. government is dumping cheap corn on you. It destroys your ability to produce and your ability to make a living. This is true in many third world countries. When the government in the U.S. supports a price above the market clearing price. They don't use a price floor for sugar, but it's the same kind of concept. They do keep the price of sugar high domestically through import controls. And what is by doing that, it prevents other producers from other worlds from producing and shipping to us, so it impoverishes the rest of the world. So what happens is U.S. farmers get rich, U.S. agribusiness gets rich, at the expense of U.S. taxpayers and the expense of other people around the world, because we've stolen their ability to make a living. It's quite immoral.
An example, I guess another example of a price floor is a minimum wage. I think that's one that people tend to think it's quite beneficial and it helps those who are at the bottom rung of the ladder. But why is that not true?
Well, if I as a business owner face the choice of hiring somebody, and let's say it's a low-skilled job, maybe somebody just out of high school, didn't graduate from high school, maybe I just need somebody to do some menial labor, and that menial labor to me is worth maybe $5 an hour. The government puts a gun to my head and says, well, if I'm going to hire this guy, I must pay him $7.50 an hour. Luke, guess what I'm going to do? Guess what I'm not going to do? I'm not going to hire him. There's no way I'm going to lose $2.50 an hour just to please the government. So what it does is create tremendous unemployment. You have a lot more people willing to work at the higher wage, but a lot fewer people willing to purchase the labor at the higher wage. It's a classic example of a government price floor. Creates unemployment.
What about tariffs then? I know that some people have called for the introduction of tariffs on goods that have been imported from China, for example, because they argue that their prices are too low and that they're uncompetitive. The argument usually goes that by raising the price of Chinese goods, it brings them more into line with the prices of goods made here in America. And so then people would then choose to buy the American goods, and this would benefit American workers. But what's wrong with that? What's wrong with this kind of...
There's so many levels at which that is false. I'm not quite sure where to begin, so let me think for a minute here. Just imagine that we don't have these arbitrary geopolitical boundaries called countries, okay? And let's just say you've got a factory in one place, somebody else has a factory in another place, and that factory is more efficient than yours, can produce things at lower cost. What do? They enter the marketplace, they take away some of your business, but who gets enriched? Consumers. Consumers now have more money to spend on everything else because they've spent less on your product. And that doesn't matter if you put an arbitrary geopolitical boundary between you and that next factory. I mean, economic forces don't stop across borders. It's just like gravity. It's a natural law. So the idea that we analyze things in terms of this country or that country is to me quite preposterous. It doesn't make sense from an Austrian perspective. It's just a matter of who can produce things cheaper, and producing things cheaper makes you better off. When Henry Ford introduced ways to make cars cheaper, he enriched the nation. He didn't impoverish the nation.
So it's actually good. I guess sometimes you think people, it's a focusing on the, they focus on workers instead of looking at people as also as consumers.
Yeah, I mean, think of all the buggy whip makers that Henry Ford put out of business. You can count them.
Yeah.
But think of all the consumers gained, and then all the workers that earned higher wages doing something more productive, working for Henry Ford, were eventually able to do. That's the force of what we call, what Schumpeter called, creative destruction, drives an economy forward through efficiencies, through becoming lower priced, through pleasing more consumers at a lower price. That's how Rockefeller got wealthy. That's how, as I mentioned before, Bill Gates and everybody else gets wealthy.
Some people could say, though, that what if that might be true, but then what about, let's just say China is better at America than everything, or they're better, they can produce everything at a much cheaper price. Then would that make an argument for being able to introduce some sort of government interventions to try and bring things more into line?
No, we can show, and through several analytical levels, and this goes back to David Ricardo, that it's not the absolute efficiency that counts. It's the relative efficiency in terms of who has a lower opportunity cost. You know, if the U.S. produces wheat at a lower opportunity cost than Mexico produces tomatoes, the converse of that must be that Mexico produces tomatoes at a lower opportunity cost than the U.S. produces wheat. There's always gains from trade, always gains from trade, as long as if one person has got a comparative advantage, then the other person has the opposite comparative advantage. So it's not just the absolute efficiency, it's the relative comparative advantage that counts.
What happens when a government attempts to stamp out a market entirely? So, for example, many recreational drugs is the easiest one to point to. The pricing mechanism still functions there, though, doesn't it?
Well, sure, because people want it and people are willing to supply it. So it doesn't make the market disappear. It just puts it underground, and it brings in more criminal activity. And by its very definition, as a consumer, you become a criminal. And producing and selling into that market, you become a criminal. And then it takes a tremendous amount of guns of government to try to control the beast that they've created.
One of the things that sometimes makes me laugh is when you'll see the police, they will have found some big, they'll have a big drug bust, and they'll present all the, you know, all the drugs that they've taken off the market, and they proudly show it off. But then they don't realize, I guess, that all they've done is just, you know, if they've to use the economics jargon, they've shifted the supply curve to the left, which means that the prices of drugs is going to go up because they've reduced the quantity, but then you've just made it more profitable now to, you know, to be selling drugs.
Right, so that's a price signal to somebody in some other place to increase their production. So the next thing you know, there's more coming across the border instead of less. It really, you know, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the very old Walt Disney cartoon called The Sorcerer's Apprentice out of Fantasia movie. But it's Mickey Mouse is up there, and he's got this wand, and he was actually cleaning, I think, an area, and he found a sorcerer's wand, and he goes up to the podium and starts waving the wand, and he has no idea of the magic behind that wand and what happens. And the next thing you know, this is happening over there, and the bucket's moving over here, and the water's sloshing over there, and he almost destroys the place. Well, the government is the sorcerer's apprentice. Somehow they have taken power, unconstitutional power, to try to control this thing we call the economy, to control quantities and prices and people's behavior, and they have absolutely no idea of the havoc they have wrecked upon us.
Also, with drugs, what ends up happening is there's a risk premium added onto the price. Could you talk about how that sort of that criminal element can come into it when it's taken something from outside the market, and there's now, when you create a black market gets created, what are some of then the ill effects of that?
Sure, that higher price, as you mentioned, is what you'd call a risk premium to the producer or the seller of that. And that simply incentivizes a different type of producer to come into the market, a more risk-oriented producer, because that price has got to outbid their risk. And it's just only natural for that to gravitate towards gangs, towards criminals. You know, when you have that kind of a black market, by definition, you get criminals, but then you get also bad people. You get bad human beings involved in that, and you're actually making them wealthy. It makes no sense whatsoever.
I know that during the early days of the Soviet Union, during the war communism period, they even, I think, attempted to eliminate profit entirely. Do you know what some of the other effects of that were in the USSR when they really tried to clamp down and control prices outright?
Yeah. When they control prices, when they try to eliminate profits, so they try to have some command and control board that would set a price equal to, quote, whatever they thought the cost was, they reduce any incentive to produce. So what's the only incentive left? A gun. Okay, so you had production by command of government instead of by people following incentives. And so it's no surprise there that you created a criminal class of kleptocrats, of bureaucrats, of apparatchiks in the political system. And they themselves were able to enrich themselves at the expense of millions of starving people and just absolute misery.
What about a monopolist? They can usually, they'll say that, well, maybe in a competitive market, there will be prices will, you know, people will be able to afford certain things. But with a monopolist, they can charge whatever they want to.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's another difference, really, Luke, between an Austrian economist who sees the moving picture and a more standard economist that just sees a picture frame and they say, oh, his guy has a monopoly at this point in time in this place. Well, if you look at the movie and you let it run, there's no such thing as a monopoly because everything competes for the consumer dollar. If you have a monopoly in producing basketballs, that doesn't give you a monopoly over consumer spending, does it? There's all kinds of things that compete for that. If I develop a brand new personal helicopter, okay, so out of my own mind, I pull an Ayn Rand out of some kind of genius area that doesn't exist, but let's imagine it does, and I invent a personal helicopter that I can produce and sell to people at maybe $12,000 cost to me, and they're willing to pay $20,000, that's a huge profit. And furthermore, I have a monopoly on that because I'm able to get a patent on it. I'm the only one in the world that's able to produce that thing. And somehow a classical or a neoclassical economist, or at least certainly a Keynesian economist, would say, oh, I've harmed society with my monopoly position. But I've created jobs, I've created wealth, I've created value that didn't exist before. And furthermore, as soon as I have that, there's some other tinkerer somewhere else thinking, you know what, look at what that guy did with his personal helicopter. I'll bet there's a way I can capture some of that market. So monopolies don't last over time. Either with a specific product or a specific process. Human ingenuity is boundless, and even the monopolies that we think of, like the early aluminum monopolies in America, they didn't last. They didn't last at all because eventually what happened? People invented other alternative products. So we have now plastic cans instead of aluminum cans for a lot of things. There's just no way to maintain a monopoly. A monopoly has to be so narrowly defined to a time and place as to be irrelevant to an Austrian economist, but they're amazingly relevant to non-Austrians who don't really understand the processes at work. They just see the snapshot.
But then we've got here, we've got antitrust laws, for example. Would you be able to explain what they are and then why you don't think that they're valid or why they're unnecessary?
Sure. The antitrust laws came about during what was called the Progressive Era of America, in the late 1800s through the early 1900s, when several major industrialists were getting quite wealthy out of the value of what they produced for so many people, and they were getting so wealthy that they started buying up other operations, and the government became very concerned that they would become monopolies, and some of them had some sort of an aspect temporarily of monopoly. Now, we already know they could not have lasted, but the government didn't like it. And in spite of all of our constitutional constraints and guarantees of property rights, the government actually came into some of these companies with their guns, stuck a gun at the CEO's head and said, or else you must break up your company. So they broke up the Standard Oil Trust, they broke up several different trusts, banking trusts and some other things, using the force of government. And the damage they did to the concept of property rights is incalculable. And the other thing is those monopolies, as I've said, would not have lasted anyway. They couldn't because it's just too ferocious. If that pile of money I'm making with my personal helicopter, that's like leaving, you know, maybe $100 million on a poker table. Somebody's going to come and figure out a way to play that game and get some of it. It's just preposterous. And the argument, to me, the Austrian argument is not so much the economics of that, in a classic sense, it's the politics of it, what that did to our understanding of private property, and all of a sudden the government could just come in and just start commanding that private property. I don't know if your listeners noticed, but just last week, the government is now telling one of the major insurance companies in America that they're not allowed to increase their dividend payout to their stockholders. Imagine that. That is beyond Soviet. That's just it ought to be just scaring people to death that the government now presumes they have the power to do that kind of thing.
What would some of the effects of that be for that, as an example of an insurance, if they start to stipulate certain things, that the prices have to be certain things or you can't pay a dividend, what would be the consequences?
Well, yeah, it's an indirect type of price control. What that's doing is how much capital is now going to flow to that industry if that industry is not allowed to pay dividends back to its shareholders. Okay, it's distorting the capital markets. It's making the economy less productive. It's costing jobs. It's costing all kinds of things. And it's costing, in my opinion, the philosophy of property rights is the greater damage than simply the lost jobs.
Because, and that's right, as we discussed earlier, people respond to incentives. They're going to change what they would otherwise invest in or where they would put their money, especially now today in the... There's so many different countries, places, areas in the world to invest money, to put capital, that I guess they would just otherwise go overseas or somewhere that's more competitive.
Well, certainly, the more fluid capital becomes, and in fact, the more fluid all resources become, labor as well, the less easy it is for any particular sovereign government to try to control this thing, because it's like pushing on one end of a balloon, it'll just pop out somewhere else. So, yeah, people are leaving America left and right to go to other places to create their wealth.
Great. Well, that brings us up to the end of this segment, and we will return soon. This is Luke McGrath on Radio Free Market, and I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Prentice. We'll be right back. We are back. This is Luke McGrath on Radio Free Market, and I'm speaking with Dr. Paul Prentice. Paul, would you have to speak, maybe we've talked about prices and how the market mechanism works. Would you have to speak about how this economic freedom then ties in with actual people's personal freedom and how intervening in prices and distorting prices then affects people, not just in their daily buying and selling of goods and services, but how that actually affects people's lives?
Sure. When you understand standard economy from an Austrian perspective, you realize that, if I could use a bumper sticker, the economy is us. In other words, the economy is what people are and what we do. So when you control the economy, that automatically implies you control people. So we have a phrase, free people, free markets. It's something we've developed here, and the idea is that they're two sides of the same coin. If you're going to have liberty, you must have free markets, and you can't have one or the other. We had an election in 2008 where apparently over half of our population in America believed they could somehow maintain a free society and vote for a command and control economy, and they're finding out it's preposterous. It's not possible. To be free, you must be free to pursue your economic interests, because that's what people do. Reagan said that, and Hayek said that. There's just so many ways that great people, going back even, you can find it quotes in the Bible, you can find quotes back into Cicero and even before that about all this, that it just requires freedom for people to produce and thrive. And if you want to control the economy, that means you're controlling the people. And guess what? As Hayek pointed out, you may have plans for your life, and they may have plans for your life, and there's very little chance that those plans are going to coincide, and they've got the guns. So it just tends to be just a disaster.
So it's kind of an artificial separation, really, to talk about economic freedom and then personal freedom. There's really just freedom.
The same thing, that's right, exactly. It's just the same thing, isn't it? It's absolutely right.
Yeah. What would you say to people who will say such things as, there are things that are more important than profit, and profit over people is a bad thing, but there's more more important things than prices, and there's some things you can't put a price, on.
I get that a lot. It's particularly grating in terms of, say, for example, the environmental movement. They'll frequently say, well, this, whatever the environmental value is just too important to leave to the marketplace. Or education is just too important to leave to the marketplace. And I've heard this, food is just too important to leave to the marketplace. You know, people, not profits. Well, it's precisely because those things are important that it should be left to the marketplace, because the marketplace is the only mechanism that can bring the greatest good to the greatest number of people at the lowest possible price. So they've got it all wrong. They absolutely have it all wrong. It's so confused, it's hard to know where to begin when you try to argue or discuss this with people who believe that.
So you don't see something wrong with, like, putting prices a price on a forest, for example, if that's actually a good thing? It would be a good thing for the forest and for people.
Because we've had prices on forests, we now have more trees in America than we did at our founding, because people make money off of trees. It's good. Profit drives resources. That profit motive is one of the most powerful human incentives there is. And as long as there's a positive spread between the price you can sell something for and what it costs you to do that, that profit signal is the signal we want. How else are you going to decide? I have your listeners imagine. How else would you decide how to control, how to allocate your resources? Would you have just government guns controlling the resources? Would you have the biggest, strongest, fastest controlling those decisions? Would you have people simply lining up for hours and whoever gets there first gets to decide how to allocate the resources? Nobody's saying that markets are perfect. It's just that they're less imperfect than all the other options.
All right, great. Well, thanks a lot for that, Dr. Prentiss. It's been really great speaking with you today.
Well, thank you, Luke. I've really enjoyed it.
Great. Well, this is Luke McGraw once again, and I'm speaking on Radio Free Market. Please visit us on the web at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes, or visit our Radio Free Market archive for easy downloads. Until next week, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thanks for listening.